Moving on, background presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For more information, check out nhhca.org. On Background is the show all about the First of the Nation presidential primary, and the filing period for President of the United States has opened here in the great state of New Hampshire. Two major candidates have filed as we do the show here on Thursday. They are Pete Buttigieg as well as Bernie Sanders. We hear from both of them here in the opening segment of the program. Then Pete Buttigieg sits down for Pints and Politics with my crew at the Barley House, and Kamala Harris calls into the program as well. Coming up on this edition of On Background, the show all about the First Nation presidential primary. Welcome in right now, Paul Steinhauser. Paul, how are you?
Good to join you. It's been busy here, yeah. But now the starting gun has begun. It's really crunch time here in New Hampshire.
It really is, and it's, you know, not to romanticize too much about the filing period, but to me, it's my most favorite part of the New Hampshire primary process, when the candidates, the supporters fill the state house, they sign up briefly for the primary, the money's handed over, say a little something, the halls are filled with chanting supporters, then meeting with some of the crusty New Hampshire media figures like ourselves to discuss their campaign and just kind of where the campaign sits at this point, and generally a rally out front of the state house as well. Brings all the candidates here to Concord into the state house, and it is a special time. We'll start with Bernie Sanders, though, as Sanders was not the first candidate to file. That was Buttigieg, but Bernie Sanders is having a bit of a comeback here. You know, we talked a couple weeks ago about how Sanders' campaign, you know, seemed to be having some difficulty. Poll numbers were down, and he was down. He had to leave the campaign trail because he had a heart attack and a couple of stents put into his heart. But his comeback after that has been phenomenal. His strongest debate performance, followed by endorsements by the three most visible progressive freshman House members, including one in New York with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And it seems like Bernie's campaign had some momentum, and the most recent UNH poll indicated that, as he's at the top with 21%, Elizabeth Warren at 18%, Joe Biden at 15%, and Pete Buttigieg at 10%.
Yep, it's a good place for Bernie Sanders right now, considering where he was just a month ago. So A for his place in the race, and B for his health. So That's good. I still think that this could have been a state that if Bernie Sanders had maybe put a little more emphasis into the state earlier in the cycle, maybe back in the late winter and early spring, it wouldn't be so close. But that's past, and he is still in a very good place. Bernie Sanders having a very good day, though his crowd for his rally noticeably smaller than 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. The rally outside the state house, part of that may be the weather. It was a rainy day. But part of that may also be, you know, it's a very different race. And he acknowledges a very different race for the Democratic nomination than 4 years ago, when if you didn't like Hillary Clinton, you were with Bernie Sanders. Now he's got a lot of people sharing the stage with him that are preaching the same ideas that he made mainstream 4 years ago.
I think you make a really good point about, you know, where Sanders' campaign is as to where it could have been if he had dedicated more time and effort early on to New Hampshire. And it brings up a key point as well, where Bernie might not do as well in Iowa as Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, and Pete Buttigieg. And New Hampshire, in my view, is his firewall. And he also needs to have a firewall in place here so that there is not a contender who comes from Iowa with momentum that can get past him. He, in my view, needs to have a good 5 to 10% lead on the field before Iowa here in New Hampshire. And now is the time for him to build that.
Yeah, and he kind of messaged that to, in his rally, in his gaggle with reporters after he filed, saying that he's going to be here a lot. You're going to see a lot of me. I'll be coming to a place near you. That was one of the lines he used a couple times.
To your town. He's going to go all across the state.
Yeah, coming to you, coming to your town. So he does need to do that. Joe Biden has a firewall in South Carolina. He's, as Bernie would say, he's got a huge lead, Biden, in the polls there. Bernie doesn't have a huge lead here. He's basically tied. He's within the sampling area in this latest poll in New Hampshire. We're going to see plenty of other surveys as well. This state is very much up for grabs. Bernie may have a slight edge right now over Biden and Warren, but it's a slight edge. So that's why we're going to see a lot more of Sanders going forward. And of course, there's the expectations game. He won this state by, what, 22 points over Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. His supporters have stayed cohesive. The steering committee's met every month since the 2016 election. There's expectations that Bernie Sanders has to win New Hampshire. We've been talking about that for a long time. Hasn't changed.
I don't think there's expectations in regards to margin, but I do think there's expectations in regards to him winning. Let's hear from Bernie on his health and how he plans to conduct his campaign. Of course, right after he had the heart attack, he met with reporters on kind of a consistent basis outside his home. And one of the things he discussed was that he was going to scale back the campaign, perhaps not do four events per day. And since then, he retracted, and has not just retracted in terms of his words, he's retracted in terms of his actions, where he is campaigning in a vigorous way, the same way that he was before. Here's Bernie Sanders. And take it out.
Needless to say, everybody knows that I had a heart procedure, two stents in my artery, which was blocked. My understanding is that that procedure takes place about 1 million times a year in the United States. I left the hospital after 2.5 days. I am back on my feet. I am feeling great, and I want to thank the people of New Hampshire and people all over this country who sent us their well wishes and prayed for us. It means a lot to me and my family. But I'm feeling great, and I expect that at the end of the day, we will probably do more events here in New Hampshire than any other candidate. We intend to have a very vigorous campaign, which takes us all over the state.
Senator, you
Bernie's trip here to New Hampshire to file coming just in the wake of some really, it seems to be almost getting personal between him and Joe Biden and their campaigns, with the Biden campaign going after Sanders over how to pay for Medicare for all, and Sanders himself, not just his campaign, slamming Biden for agreeing to have a super PAC assist his campaign. I asked him about that in the gaggle. Take a listen.
It just seems in the last couple of days it's getting a little personal between you and the former vice president, from Medicare to all to super PACs, which you just mentioned. And I'm wondering what this relationship is like, and is it getting a little more testy now in the campaign trail?
Well, I've known Joe for many years, and I consider Joe to be a friend. But campaigns are about ideas, they're about values. If my memory is correct, Joe Biden once said, and I'm paraphrasing, is that you got to be careful about people who have super PACs and who they will end up being responsible for. And in this campaign, Joe is, I understand that, has not done particularly well in getting a lot of donations from working class people. At this particular moment in this campaign, and I'm extraordinarily proud of this, we have received more donations than any candidate in the history of the United States of America at this point in an election. We have over 1 million Americans who have donated to our campaign, and the average donation is $16. These are working class people supporting a working class campaign. Joe has not had that result, and he is now forced to go to billionaires and multimillionaires to get his funding through a super PAC. Second of all, the criticism about Medicare for all and how you pay for it. I would hope that Joe Biden explains to the American people how, under his plan, which maintains a dysfunctional, wasteful, and cruel healthcare system, a system today which is costing us twice as much per person as do the people of any other industrialized country pay.
A couple things there. First off is that Joe Biden and his campaign feel that, particularly in a state like New Hampshire, there's a big advantage to going after Bernie Sanders on Medicare for All, and that a public option is something that polls well with primary voters here in the Granite State. So they feel that that's a good fight for them to pick with Bernie Sanders. From Bernie Sanders' perspective, a super PAC represents all the things that he does not like. It represents, corporate special interests, large dollars, and all the things that he, talks about a lot. So it's the super PAC process itself that he does not like. And I think that he also, I think, to some extent he expected this from Biden, but there is perhaps a tinge of personal nature of this.
Yeah, it is getting testy between the two of them, and it's even getting a little testy now between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. You've seen him make clear contrast with Warren in recent days as well, Chris.
Yeah, let's hear that clip as well, where he was asked about Warren and basically said that Warren was not was new to the fight, and that he had been fighting for these things for a long period of time. He didn't reference Warren specifically, and wanted to follow up on that, but didn't get the chance. But here's that comment.
Now, Macy, Elizabeth.
Well, I'm not here to disparage Senator Warren or anybody else. I have tried very carefully in this campaign to run an issue-oriented campaign. Senator Warren is a friend of mine. So I'm not here to criticize her or anybody else. She'll make her case to the people as we do. But this is what I do want to say. Some of you may know that I'm 78 years of age. I know this is a secret. We've tried to keep it under the radar screen, but it has gotten out.
Never would have guessed.
So the point is, there is an advantage having been in politics for a long time. What's that advantage? The advantage is that the ideas that I am fighting for today, and I know you guys research this, these are not new ideas for me. I've been talking about health care as a human right and Medicare for all for decades. I've been talking about the need to raise the minimum wage to a living wage for decades. I've been on more picket lines, I suspect, than all of my opponents.
All right, that is Bernie Sanders right there. Pete Buttigieg filed for the First Nation presidential primary prior to Sanders the day before on Wednesday. And, you know, his campaign is in a really interesting spot right now where we had wondered for months and months and months who was going to be the individual that would emerge in the new leadership lane, a lane where there was a lot of excitement, there was a lot of anticipation for a candidate to emerge. And Buttigieg, in terms of his polling, his debate performance, his fundraising, and his organization, and I think his message too, seems to be the individual that is most likely to fill that lane in Iowa and in New Hampshire.
Pete Buttigieg is in a very, very good place. I totally agree. Here in the latest polls, he's around 10% behind the top three. And he's got a ton of money. He's raised a lot of money. He's beefing up his staffs in the early voting states. So, yeah. And he had a very good day here on Wednesday, the first major name to file. And here's how it went down. He filed, came back and gaggled with reporters. Then before he did his rally and before he sat down with you and for politics, Pints and Politics, he did a couple of quick one-on-one interviews, including one with me. And I started out light. We got serious in a minute, but I started out by asking him about lobster rolls. Take a listen.
Inside the historic State House. Before we get serious, first of all, I got to ask you, you've been up here a lot over the last, 9 months. What's your favorite lobster roll?
I can't say that I've reached the point of being a lobster roll connoisseur, but I haven't yet met one that I didn't like, so I'll just have to keep sampling until I'm a more educated eater of them.
I thought we were past this, but this morning, headlines both in Politico and USA Today about this new poll that indicated that, more than half of, 37% of Americans had trouble with a candidate who was gay as president. Should we be past this by now, and is this a concern for your campaign?
I think the way to get past it is for voters to have a clear sense of what's at stake in their lives based on who the president is, in the same way that I was able to get reelected with 80% of the vote in Indiana during the governorship of Mike Pence after coming out. I believe the American people will, at the end of the day, settle this question based on who they think is going to be the best president to serve them and make their lives better.
You don't see it as a roadblock, though? 37% of this country, of the electorate, has a problem with you.
I think that the biggest thing that's on the minds of voters is whether they're getting paid enough, whether they're going to be able to get health care, how they're going to save for retirement. And serving up an answer to that, I think, is how we can get past a lot of old prejudices, as America has time and time again proven itself capable of moving forward, not back, on these issues.
I was with Elizabeth Warren last night, and we were asking her about when this new plan is coming out, that how she'll pay for Medicare for all. It's taking some time. Is this an issue? Is this a concern?
I certainly think we all have a responsibility to explain how our plans are going to be paid for. And my concern about the plan that she's putting forward is not just the multi-trillion-dollar hole, but also the fact that most Americans would prefer not to be told that they have to abandon their private plan. I want to create this public plan, and then if it's the right plan for everybody, everybody will want it. If it's not the right plan for some people, then some people will keep the plan they've got. I think that's the best policy. It's definitely what most voters, including what most Democratic voters, believe. And I believe those voters are not wrong.
Two quick questions, two final ones. Joe Biden, we've got to talk about him. He's kind of the roadblock in front of you right now for that kind of centrist lane that you're hoping voters will come your way. Are his stumbles, are his gaffes, is this a troublesome sign?
Well, what I'd say is that in order to win, we need to put forward a candidate who can demonstrate the readiness to lead this country forward. We're going to have to turn the page. And it's not as simple as the idea of going back to normal. We've really got to build up a new normal. I'll also say, when it comes to electability, every single time my party has won the presidency in the last 50 years, it's been with a candidate who was new on the national scene, hadn't spent a lot of time in Washington, and represented a new generation of leadership. By contrast, every single time in the last 50 years, we have put forward the most Washington-oriented candidate. We have come up short in November.
Finally, you've raised a lot of money, and that means you're able to do things. You've gone up with TV ads in Iowa now a couple times, but not here. How come you don't want to kind of raise your recognition, your name recognition here in this state?
Oh, you'll be seeing a lot of us here in New Hampshire, both in terms of our commitments with investments, our large and growing ground game, and the use of my time. Because I think New Hampshire is the state that will really catapult me towards success in the nomination.
And does that mean you need to finish first, second, third here? Is there a number?
I'm not going to set up a goalpost just yet. Obviously, there are some competitors with a neighborhood advantage, but we do think that we can do well here. And when we do, that'll be a key part of our path to the nomination.
Mr. Mayor, thank you for your time.
Thanks.
That is Pete Buttigieg with Paul Steinhauser. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. When we return, part of our Pints and Politics show that we did with Pete Buttigieg down in the B Lounge of the Barley House, surrounded by a really good crowd. I was glad to see everybody come out for that. Here is Pints and Politics, but first, this commercial break. You're listening to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, the show that is all about the First the Nation presidential primary. The filing period has opened. Candidates headed to Secretary of State Bill Gardner's office to sign up for the First the Nation presidential primary. The first major candidate to do so was Pete Buttigieg. After that, he joined us for Pints and Politics at the Barley House. I'm curious as to your reflections as you walk into that office, we're both the same age, and sign up to be a candidate for President of the United States. What was that like?
Well, I have to say, and maybe it's the veteran in me, I have kind of a soft spot for ceremony and tradition. So, of course, we've been campaigning for a long time, but to participate in that ritual of officially becoming a candidate, it means something. Especially seeing the famous desk that has been where this takes place for something like 100 years. In fact, I think exactly 100 years of the tradition of New Hampshire having that place in the calendar. Just reminds me that this is part of something so much bigger, even bigger than something as big as the 2020 election, which is the tradition of American democracy.
So in that moment, though, what goes through your mind? Because you're obviously an historic candidate as well. You'd be the first gay president of the United States of America, and that has been a big part of who you are, and I think is significant, obviously. So what is the kind of the all-encompassing type of feeling when you put your name on the ballot?
You know, anytime you sign anything, you're making a promise. You're attaching your name, your reputation to an idea or a commitment, or in this case, a course of action. Mm-hmm. And it's an awareness of the responsibility that comes with that too. I'm very mindful every day of the responsibilities, even as a candidate, just before the first vote is even cast. The responsibilities that I have to speak for the people who have put so much of their hope in this candidacy, and to speak to the people who have so much on the line, as we all do, in the question of who our next president is going to be and what values are going to prevail at the ballot box this year.
You mentioned the direction. Where do you wish to lead this nation? You know where we are. Everyone knows where we are at this point in time. The next president is going to have an incredible responsibility to unite a nation, to heal a nation, and then to bring a nation forward.
That's right.
What is the direction and the path that you wish to take this nation?
Well, the direction is to deliver on shared priorities that the American people have in the name of our shared values that have just been completely neglected by Washington, not just in the corruption of the current administration, but in many ways across my lifetime. And now is the time to lead the country forward. I'm running to be president, not just in order to replace the current president, but because of what we're going to need that first day after Donald Trump's presidency has come to an end, one way or the other. And what we're going to need is a president who can unite the American people. And the good news is there's a strong American majority for the things that I am proposing that we do on everything from raising wages to delivering health care to everybody to making sure that we have paid family leave, all the way through to issues like guns and immigration and, of course, climate change, some issues where Democrats have been on defense in the past. Right now there's a strong American majority to do the right thing and to bring as many people as possible along to. We're not going to win over everybody, but we can let everybody know they belong in this same big American project of moving our country ahead. That's the kind of president I seek to be.
Dean?
Yeah, Mayor Pete, let's get right to talking about health care. I just saw some more data a few days ago. It says that health care is the number one issue among Democratic primary voters. And you've talked a lot already, certainly in the debates with Elizabeth Warren, about Medicare versus Medicare for all. But what I'm interested in is a different aspect of the health care equation, something that I heard a lot more about during the initial debates around Obamacare, and that's the actual cost of medical care itself. So not so much even prescription drugs, although you can talk about that, but the actual Medicare itself. And, you know, that was one of the kind of the big areas that I think was under discussed in previous presidential last couple of cycles. The fact that many people will say that it's the cost of medical care that is the problem that is driving a lot of these issues with premiums and the ability to insure people. So say a little bit, how would you deal with, you can talk about prescription drugs, but medical care costs more broadly.
It's a really good point.
Yeah, it's true. And it's for whatever reason not considered as sexy, but it is as big a part of the problem as the question
of how to get
everybody
coverage.
You don't hear a lot about
it, though. Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to have a hot debate over how to automate prior authorizations in CMS, right? But we're going to have to figure out how to get this stuff done. And you're right. A part of it, of course, is prescription drugs. We've got a plan that will dramatically reduce the cost of prescription drugs. But it's also the overall cost of the system. Now, having said that, we spend more of our healthcare dollar on administrativia compared to patient care than any other developed country. And so we know a lot of this is on the administrative side. It's why we need to make reforms under the hood in Medicare, especially if we're getting more people on Medicare or something like it, in addition to making sure that we press private payers to do a better job of controlling those administrative costs. There are also things in terms of the billing side and providers, especially as we have more and more consolidation to the point of monopoly by for-profit hospital systems. We do have to face the fact that that is also an upward pressure on costs, and we're going to need to require through things like legislation that caps surprise billing. Making sure that we are dealing with the cost side as well. Otherwise, getting everybody covered just puts that much more pressure on the debt and the deficit. Mm-hmm. And I know Democrats aren't supposed to talk about deficits, but I care about it an awful lot. And I think that, you know, because Republicans have revealed once they take office that they don't care at all about deficits, our party's going to have to take the lead on that issue, too.
Mm-hmm. Is that will you hit Trump on the deficit? I mean, we've seen over $600 billion added to the deficit just this year. Do you think that's a vulnerability for Republicans, and can Democrats become more of a party of fiscal responsibility, where in the past it's been the opposite?
Absolutely. You know, the very same congressional Republicans who told us that we couldn't have basic infrastructure or education investments because it would do something to the deficit enthusiastically voted to blow up the deficit to its trillion-dollar level that we're at today. Mm-hmm. There needs to be some accountability for that. You know, I think about this generationally because I expect to be here when some of these financial time bombs go off. And the really important thing to realize is that if we are smart and responsible about revenue as well as cost, we can absolutely finance the priorities of the American people without blowing up the deficit or having unreasonable levels of taxation. But it means making the right kind of investments, and it means being responsible about revenue, too.
Yes. So, Mayor Pete, the number two issue among Democratic primary voters up here is climate change.
With health care being the first.
Health care being number one, then climate change. We've had a real battle here in New Hampshire, a real ideological battle over the last 10 years. We've had Democratic governors who were focused on renewable energy and setting targets for renewable energy, even if it meant subsidizing those industries. And then when it came time to actually build wind farms and put in hydro power projects, everything got bogged down in the courts. It took 10 years just to get one little wind program. Finally, they're just beginning construction now. Now we have a Republican governor who has said, no, we're not going to subsidize renewables. If renewables can compete, that's great. What we're going to do is focus on the cost of electricity. And however we can bring down that cost of electricity, whether it's, as President Trump says, coal and oil or natural gas. Our governor now wanted to build some natural gas pipelines. That got bogged down in the courts as well. So it really feels to me like there's an ideological battle about what we should do. But in practice, no one really seems to be able to do anything. And I've been watching this problem very closely for at least 10 years in the state, and it just seems like nobody's making a lot of progress.
Can you do both? Can you bring down costs
fair way to put
and
it,
be more environmentally friendly and to pay, not pay homage is not the right word, but acknowledge the challenges of climate change. Do you think you can do both as president?
Well, I think, first of all, we got to be honest about what cost means. There's more to cost than the sticker price of a kilowatt hour, especially when there are going to be long-run destructive consequences to climate change and the ways in which our fossil fuel economy doesn't exactly stand on its own two feet when you count the subsidies.
And to be clear, Governor Sununu was talking about the price on your bill every month.
Exactly. He's talking about the sticker utility price, which is incredibly misleading. But I do think there is a way for more people to win. And look, we can't afford for this to be a partisan issue. It would be as if in America there were partisan disagreement on whether cancer existed. It's a disaster for something this important and this destructive to be a partisan issue. And it's one of the reasons why I think the real distinction in my plan, I mean, I have a plan to get us carbon neutral by 2050. So do my competitors. The real difference is that a lot of what's in my plan is focused on ensuring that it can actually get done by recruiting more Americans to be part of it. I'm thinking about this from a South Bend, Indiana perspective. I'm thinking about how to make sure that an auto worker who lives a couple blocks from me sees how they fit among the 3 million net new jobs we're proposing to create through a new and more carbon-efficient economy. I'm thinking about the cornfield, a short jog away from my house, that could be part of the solution on climate change.
Even ethanol has kind of been sucked into this now, the use of ethanol.
Yeah, it's not just the ethanol for sure, and also what we can do with soil management, cover crops. Look, the original carbon capture technology is called trees, and there are a lot of reasons to believe that rural America, which is right now feeling like they're being beaten over the head and told they're the problem, is a huge part of the indispensable part of the solution, and we need to recruit all Americans to be part of this, because this is going to require such a mobilization that it only works if the main emotion that we all feel as Americans when it comes to the topic of climate is not guilt but pride. And that only happens if we are achieving something beyond what we ever thought possible. It's what I hope to enlist the American people to help do.
Wayne?
So this is a two-parter. These are very tough questions getting ready to come at you now. So it's November the 4th. You've been elected president of the United States. What's the first thing you want to do in office? Question one. Question two. After having experience filing for the New Hampshire First in the Nation primary, are you prepared to say now, as president, you will preserve New Hampshire's First in the Nation status? I told you they'd be tough questions.
So you can count on me. The answer to the second question is yes.
Excellent.
And
we'll check in with you on February 12th about that.
Sounds good. And the bigger concern, I think, is that the next president's got to pick up the pieces on our whole country, including our social fabric. So I could walk you through the policy priorities around climate, around democratic reform and fixing our democracy, around the economy and making sure it works for everybody. Those are all day one things we're going to work on, launching legislation as well as executive work. But the other thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to ask people who voted one way to call up somebody they love who voted the other way and talk about something besides politics and think about why they love them. Because we can't go on like this as a country. We're not going to pretend. We're not going to wave away our differences. We're going to contest them vigorously in politics. But the problems that are at the feet of this country cannot be confronted if we are not one country. And the number one job of the president, it sounds less substantive and more symbolic, but it's deeply important, is to do everything in your power to hold the American people together.
Do you anticipate winning here in New Hampshire?
Certainly expecting to do well. We will, we're in it to win it. And we know there's some folks with neighborhood advantages up here.
Yeah.
And even so, I think that we can really compete and do well. And I think that a great result in New Hampshire could catapult us toward the nomination in the states that follow. So you're going to see us early and often up here.
Final thing. They ask us of all the presidential candidates. The year is 2029. You've served two terms in office. What will you have left the American people? What do you want your legacy to be as President of the United States?
I would want it to be said that our country faced our toughest challenges, that we were no longer on the brink of climate catastrophe, that we had acted to bring more equity to our country, that we were more racially integrated, that that when the GDP goes up, you actually feel it in your life getting better, not just numbers on a page. And above all, that by the end of the decade, we feel like we really are one American people. Not agreeing on everything, we never will, that's not the point. But that when we face the biggest challenges before us, we do it together. And if we don't have the same values all the time, at the very least, we share the same reality.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Welcome to the program right now. Democratic presidential candidate and U.S. Senator from California, Kamala Harris. Senator Harris, how are you?
I am well. It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Awesome. Appreciate you joining us for the show. So the last time we spoke, your campaign was rising. It seemed like you were ascending towards the nomination. I'm curious as to how you see your campaign right now and kind of the ebb and flow of this process.
Well, I mean, you said it, Chris. The process involves ebbs and flows. And I'll tell you, I have learned over with good experience that it is not wise to kind of go on the roller coaster of polls
right.
and rise and fall with those. It's about steady, consistent, hard work, and that's what at the end of the day makes all the difference, and it produces a winning campaign. And so that's what I'm doing. We've been building up our incredible staff in New Hampshire and the other primary states who are working hard. We are on the ground organizing folks. There's so many people who have been coming to our events who have never been involved before. So we have what we've named Camp Kamala, and we are training people on how to organize voters and get them registered to vote. And it's all very exciting. I'm really enjoying the process, and it's one day at a time and steady.
What do you see as being your roadmap to the nomination? In my view, the early primary states are so, so important. And either needs to be, in my view, a win or a close second if a candidate is going to have a real chance of the nomination going into Super Tuesday in either Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, or Nevada. I mean, what is your roadmap to the nomination? Do you agree with that you have to win a state or get close to second? It seems like you're focusing heavily on Iowa at this point.
Well, what my campaign has said publicly, and it because this is our strategy, is that we need to come out in the top three. And, the reality of it is that of the top three polling candidates, each one has been on the national stage for decades, actually. And so the challenge for my campaign is that we are introducing ourselves to people. But the great news is that all of the polling also indicates that 70%, as many as 70% of the voters, are undecided, which
yes.
means that even right when they are familiar, they've not committed. And that is I believe, a great advantage, gives us a great advantage that there are a lot of people who are undecided, and the hard work that we need to do then is introduce ourselves. I'll tell you that my whole mission and lane, if you will, on this campaign is I believe justice is on the ballot, and the issues that are waking people up in the middle of the night around our country are exactly that. Not only are people gravely concerned about the state of our democracy and the fact that, frankly, we have a lawless president, but the issues, fundamental issues of justice, such as economic justice, when almost half of American families can't afford a $400 unexpected expense, when 30 million people in our country are without health care, when we have seniors taking buses to Canada to buy the prescription drugs because otherwise they're making critical decisions about whether they fill their prescription or fill their refrigerator. We are facing issues of justice that are about reproductive health care and women's access to reproductive health care. Educational justice, when we look at the fact that 94% of public school teachers come out of their own pocket to pay for school supplies, and so many of them are working two and three jobs in order to pay the bills, but they have a passion and a calling for being educators. These are fundamental issues of justice, and what I'm finding is that traveling throughout New Hampshire and the other primary states, that these are the conversations people want to have. When they show up at town halls, they're not asking, hey, the thing that keeps me up at night is this whole debate about socialism versus capitalism.
Right.
What they're talking about are fundamental issues that are, kitchen table issues, And those are the issues that I address. And I think that this is a moment in time, again, where we have to understand that America, this country that we love, has not done so well in supporting working families. And we need to address that. We also need to address the fact that we need someone on that debate stage who can successfully prosecute the case against 4 more years of Donald Trump and frankly, perhaps a bit immodestly, I'd say that I think it's going to take a prosecutor to do that, and I believe I have the ability to do that. But I'll also say, Chris, that I said fundamentally in this moment, we also need to recognize that we are exhausted. People are exhausted. And we have had so many powerful forces that have been trying to sow hate and division and have Americans turn on each other. And I believe it is critically important that we heal and heal around the fact that we, the vast majority of us, have so much more in common than what separates us, and so we must unify as a country. And that's part of the reason I'm running, to one, deal with these issues of justice, but also to unify our country.
I think one of the strongest arguments for your candidacy is how articulate you are and the ability that you have to prosecute the case against Donald Trump. And you look back at your biggest moment, perhaps, in the process so far, and that was on the debate stage of Joe Biden, where you were able to really show, in my view, what it would be like if you were to debate Donald Trump. Do you feel, though, that there is a need for you on the debate stage to start prosecuting the case in an artful way with your opponents in order to regain some momentum? And would that be a strategy of yours going into the next debate in November?
Well, I think that there's no question that there are differences between us on policy, and those should be debated. That is the point of that process when it has merit. But I have also taken a vow for myself that I'm not going to attack, nor will I support, Democrats attacking one another. Mm-hmm. That's not in the best interest of, I don't think, anything, frankly. And so that's how I feel. But certainly we're getting to a point that voters are starting to pay more attention, and they are looking at what are the contrasts, how are they going to compare candidates. And I'm prepared to make my case. I'm prepared to make my case again that this is a fight for justice. I'm prepared to make my case on something like health care, and this is a point of distinction between me and some of my colleagues on the debate stage. I have a Medicare for All plan, but it does not take away people's choice around private coverage, because I heard from so many people and said, Kamala, we want to have our choice, and many of us want to keep a private plan, or we want a private plan. Don't take that choice away from us. So that's the difference between me and other supporters of a different Medicare for All plan. So there will be distinctions, and I think, also as the stage narrows, and, God willing, I'm on that stage, I think that the comparisons will be more obvious. But ultimately, we have to be unified as a party.
I want to ask you about Medicare for All in regards to Elizabeth Warren, where it seems like to me, and maybe it's just the climate right now, and there's such this focus on impeachment, but it seems that when you would have a miscue or Joe Biden would have a miscue, that there was this hyper focus on what took place, but particularly on this issue. And Elizabeth Warren has been really unwilling to answer exactly how she's going to pay for Medicare for All. And you look even at Bernie's plan, Bernie's been pretty transparent about it. There's still a significant amount of money that's unaccounted for, as you well know from reading the legislation. Do you feel that Warren has been given perhaps too much of a pass, given her front-runner status, on the fact that she has not been able to answer this question?
I mean, I think that there's no question that everyone has to answer. And I certainly have, to your point, been asked a lot of questions about where I stand, and I am prepared to answer all of those questions in detail and answer them directly, and each candidate should be able to do that. There's no question about that.
In conclusion,
because especially on an issue like health care, it's such a fundamental issue in terms of, again, the issues that wake people up in the middle of the night. I mean, Chris, I can't tell you the number of people I've been meeting who are telling horror stories that range from a first grade teacher I met recently, and she has a high school daughter. They have formed a group called Mamas for Kamala. And the first grade teacher, health insurance for her family of four would cost $1,300. She cannot afford it. So she has no health insurance. Right?
Yeah.
It's the people I've met who have family members especially senior family members who are stretching their prescriptions because they can't afford to renew it, to the point that they're not taking the medication as directed, right, as frequently as they need to. And then they go into a health crisis, which means that they plateau to a much lower level instead of remaining steady. It's really outrageous. And so the healthcare issue is really one of the most important matters of justice. The way I think about it is there are three essential functions of government: public education, public safety, and public health. And on this issue, anybody who is running for president, anyone who plans to lead our nation, must take a role of leadership and understand the details of what is involved to address the issue.
In conclusion, you referenced prosecuting the case against President Trump, and you're going to be potentially, most likely, a juror on the case of President Trump in the United States Senate. I'm curious as to what you sense from your Senate colleagues on the Republican side and their willingness to perhaps remove Donald Trump from office. And do you feel that there is a likelihood or chance that he is not the Republican nominee?
Well, we'll see. I mean, what I am seeing, Chris, is that I'm seeing Republicans show up at my events, and they are there. You know, when they talk to me, you know, there aren't a lot. I don't want to misinform you, but they, you know, and many of them are coming because their daughters are bringing them. But what they're talking about in terms of why they are there is that they feel that we need to restore integrity of our government and our rule of law and our democracy, and the impeachment process is a big part of fighting for that, right? And making sure that we are true to the intention of our framers of our Constitution, the founders of our nation, which is that there will be checks and balances whenever there is an abuse of power by any branch. And I think that what we'll see in terms of the Republicans who speak up, we'll see. Sadly, over the course of the 2.5 years I've been in Washington, it's been rare. And those who speak up don't run for re-election. Or there is, of course, the late, great hero John McCain. But I haven't seen many displays of courage when it comes to my Republican colleagues' ability or willingness to speak out publicly against Donald Trump. They do roll their eyes in private, but I don't know what's going to happen about any public rebuke.
Senator Harris, appreciate your time. Look forward to seeing you back in New Hampshire when you file for the primary on November the 7th, and we'll talk again soon.
I look forward to talking to you soon. Thank you. Take care.
Kamala Harris here on Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Paul will rejoin me, and we'll wrap things up after this. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, along with Paul Steinhaus. We wrap up this edition of the show. We have more filings taking place next week, particularly towards the latter portion of next week. That is going to be a really, really big time over at the State House as we see a number of candidates come in. Elizabeth Warren, to my knowledge, has not said when she's going to file as of yet. Has she?
No, she hasn't, but we know it's now the 12th.
Okay.
So that's the following week, last week. Now, a couple questions next week. The big one, of course, will be Kamala Harris. She's scheduled to file on the 7th. Will she be here in person, or will her husband or somebody else file for her? That is a big question mark. Of course, that same day, we know Mike Pence, the vice president, is here. And, you know, for his trip, he's filing, obviously, on behalf of the president. And I think for him, it's more about 2024 than 2020. And then on Friday of that week, next Friday, we got Joe Biden and Beto O'Rourke.
Right. So on Harris, you know, we just heard from her, obviously, in the previous interview. Big news this week after that, I talked with her, that she was pulling staff from New Hampshire and other early states to focus on Iowa. Now, her focus had been in Iowa prior to that. To me, it makes sense from both perspectives as to whether she comes or not. If she has success in Iowa, you know, she might be able to reap some rewards here in New Hampshire, you know, finish fourth or fifth and then move on after that and, you know, campaign here vigorously over that week. So you may want to drop in and, you know, take some of the hard questions about, oh, you're pulling out of New Hampshire, and be like, no, I'm not pulling out of New Hampshire. I'm just going to focus on Iowa. And then we're going to see where things fall after that as we regain our fundraising efforts. So I think to me, it makes more sense for her actually to come, maybe do an event, and then that basically be it until after Iowa's over, if she has success there.
Yeah, we haven't seen a lot of her here, but now this news is troubling, right? Her campaign hemorrhaging campaign cash, spending more than it's bringing in. That's why there are going to be reductions here in New Hampshire and in the headquarters in Baltimore, as well as in South Carolina, put all the emphasis in Iowa. It'll be interesting to see what she does if she comes here next week.
Also next week, Joe Biden on Friday. Mike Pence, the vice president of the United States, will file as well, we assume, for Donald Trump. No, I'm just kidding. He will file for Donald Trump. He will not white out Donald Trump's name and put his own name.
Wouldn't that be a story?
On there. But
wait, you know what? You're burying the lead. The lead is Monday when Marianne Williamson and John Delaney file the State House. I know I'll see you there with myself.
Well, I don't know if there's a need to have both of us there. I think perhaps a divide and conquer type of endeavor. I want to make sure that I have my best game and put my best foot forward for the latter portion of the week. But I think if you're going to be there, I think you can cover it for us.
Okay, good to know.
That is Paul Steinhauser. I am Chris Ryan. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.